Good afternoon. In January 1897, Mr. A.J. Philpott of the Boston Globe found himself traveling toward Mexico City on the longest and most hopeless assignment he'd ever been given. His instructions were to find and bring back alive Dean Bridgman Connor, a young lad from Burlington, Vermont, who had died in Mexico City 3 years previously. Here's what had happened. Dean Connor, son of the Burlington, Vermont postmaster, had gone to Mexico City in 1894. A few weeks after his arrival there, his father received a letter from the American consul saying that Dean was dangerously ill with typhoid fever. Then a few days later, another letter came saying that Dean had died. The consul wrote, "I placed an American flag on the casket and left some lilies. And knowing that you'd want your son to have the best, I ordered him placed in a brick and cement-lined tomb. His personal effects will be forwarded in a few days. But when the box of Dean's things arrived in Vermont, his personal papers were missing. There was no sign of his jewelry or his bank book, all of which aroused the family's suspicions. Then Postmaster Connor had a strange dream in which he saw his son handcuffed to the bars of a window, and he heard him calling, 'I'm not dead. I was kidnapped by some bandits. Send help before it's too late.' Well, at the suggestion of friends, the matter was brought to the attention of the Society for Psychic Research, and a noted spiritualistic medium was engaged at $40 a seance to see what she could get from the spirit world. She was not told one word about Dean Bridgman Connor or Mexico City, and by jingoes, that woman went into a trance, and she said, 'The boy you are so anxious about is alive and in danger. He was kidnapped from a hospital and is being held for ransom.' Well, that was enough to send Mr. Prentice Dodge, a friend of the family up in Burlington, Vermont, post haste to Mexico City. And to his great surprise, he found that Dean Connor had not been buried in a brick tomb for which his father had paid a lot of money, nor had any American flags or flowers been left at the grave. Mr. Dodge was unable to get an interview with the consul or Dean's nurse, so he ordered the body exhumed and photographed, and then he returned home. Now, up to this point, there'd been nothing in the American newspapers except the bare announcement of Dean's death. Not a word about the family's suspicions or the fact that the famous Mrs. Piper was holding seances. But when the grave in Mexico City was opened, the story broke in the Mexican press. And it was, of course, immediately picked up by the American papers with headlines, "Foul play feared in Connor case," "Noted medium claims Connor alive," and all that kind of stuff. And at the inquest, the photographs from Mexico showed nothing that resembled the son of the Burlington postmaster. The local dentist up there in Vermont looked at some teeth that were sent up, and he said, "These do not check with Connor's chart. I don't believe they belong to him." And the family physician, holding part of the skull, said, "I am positive this is not from the head of Dean Connor, and not one single member of Dean's family could identify the locks of hair that had been sent up." All this got into the papers, and overnight, the Dean Bridgman Connor case became an international incident with serious implications. So the Boston Globe sent Anthony J. Philpott to Mexico City to get the facts. If Dean Connor was alive, he was ordered to find him and bring him back. If he was dead, he was to prove it. In either case, the Boston Globe intended to solve the mystery once and for all. Now, during his long voyage to Mexico, Philpott had plenty of time to sort out his material. Besides hundreds of newspaper clippings, he had notes taken during his talks with Prentice Dodge, the man who'd been down to Mexico before him. And he had a pencil sketch drawn by Mrs. Piper while she was in a trance. It showed mountains in the distance, a stone bridge, and a statue in the foreground. And on the statue was the word Zaragoza. The instructions were definite. "Go to Puebla, Mexico. Find this bridge and statue. Look over the top of the statue's head, and on the distant mountainside you will see a small white-roofed building, the private sanitarium of Dr. Zinch. There, in room number 4, you will find Dean Connor. But time is short. Hurry, hurry." Well, when Philpott reached Mexico City and tried to buy a ticket for Puebla, he learned that smallpox was raging there, and no tickets were being sold. He knew it would be very dangerous to make the trip, but he managed to get to Puebla just the same. And the first thing he ran into was the bridge and the statue which Mrs. Piper had drawn while she was in a trance 3,000 miles away in Boston. And what did he find on the base of that statue but the name Zaragoza? It was the general who had defended the city against the French in 1862. But no matter where he walked, up, down, or sideways, squinting through his telescope, he couldn't find any white roof building. So he returned to Mexico City and went to visit the American hospital. The matron showed him all the records, completely confirming that young Dean Connor had died of typhoid fever and had been buried in the hospital lot number 559. She said if his nurse, Miss Smith, was only here, she could tell you. Philpott jumped, recalling that back in Boston, Mrs. Piper had said, "The nurse's name is Smith." Then he asked, "Where can I find her?" The matron hesitated. "Well," she said, "I guess I might as well tell you. Quite by accident, she gave one of the other patients the wrong medicine, and the man died. And thinking she'd be charged with murder, Miss Smith ran away with a man named Wynne. I hear they've been married. I wish I knew where she is because I want her to know that no charge has been lodged against her." Philpott said, "Well, you make up an affidavit and have all the doctors and the officials sign it, and I'll give it to her, because I am not going back to Boston until I have found and talked with the nurse who took care of Dean Bridgman Connor." His next visit was at the consulate, where Mr. Crittenden received him cordially, and he said, "Philpott, you're on a wild goose chase. That boy simply got typhoid fever and died. And that's all there is to it. All this business about being kidnapped and spirit messages, poof," he said, "it's all hot air." And he snapped his fingers. And then Philpott said, "Well, where can I find this man, Wynne, who just married the nurse that Connor had?" The consul scowled and said, "Well, I'll tell you. He has a small hacienda in Maravatayo, but it's a long way off. Devilish tough country, filled with bandits. In fact, we had a couple of killings there last week. I don't advise your going to Maravatayo." But Philpott had already decided. But before he started, he went down to see Mr. Orange, the man who had employed Dean Connor in the first place. "Good Lord," he said, "are they still fussing about him? I'll tell you frankly, I wasn't a bit surprised when he took sick. Young Connor wasn't a bit careful about where or what he ate, and I never knew him to bother to boil his drinking water." So Philpott got underway. The tiny train that he took puffed and wheezed up the steep mountain grades, and when it rattled over trestles spanning the deep gorges, Philpott closed his eyes. It was hot in the car, and he was covered with soot and cinders, and he wanted to drink a cold water, but of course there wasn't any. So when the train stopped at Tuzpan Junction, Philpott stepped out to get a breath of fresh air. And then as the engine tooted, he climbed aboard the last car and was about to sit down when something seemed to lift him up and propel him bodily into the next car forward. They'd almost reached the top of the next steep grade when there were loud screams. And glancing back, Philpott saw the last car hurtling down the track. It had come uncoupled, and at the first curve, it left the rails, plowed over the rough ground, and plunged out of sight. Every person on that last car was instantly killed. Philpott told me a few weeks ago, it was then, Blackie, that I recalled what Mrs. Piper had told me back in Boston before I left. She said, "You'll be in great danger many times, but your spirit friends will watch over and protect you." Well, sir, he got off that train at the next stop, never dreaming what it might get him into. And as the train disappeared into the haze of twilight, the Globe reporter found himself in a wild and rugged wilderness. There were no houses, no shops, no hotel, nothing. And he could have kicked himself for being so foolish. He couldn't even lie down alongside the railroad track for fear of rattlesnakes. Night came on quickly, and with it a raw, cold wind and stinging sand. Then suddenly he saw a light in a grove of half-dead trees. And screwing up his courage, he marched boldly toward an old, unpainted, dilapidated freight car. And he banged on the door. The man who answered his knock was tall, thin, and decidedly British. "Come in, friend, come in and join me at tea. I'm just out of brandy, blast it." And he went on to explain that he was on a painting jaunt. He was an artist, and he was roughing it. And then he added, "My companion, blast it, had to go to the hospital. He fell in love with his nurse and got married. So now I'm all alone." Philpott could barely get out the words. "Your friend's name wasn't Wynne by any chance?" "Oh, but of course. How did you guess?" "You want to see him? Why, wonderful. Just 3 days' ride from here, over the top of yonder mountains. We can start in the morning." The next 3 days were tough ones for the tenderfoot from Boston. Philpott wasn't used to such hard riding, and the extreme temperatures of blazing sunlight and bitter cold nights brought on chills and fever. And he was indeed thankful when his companion pointed to a patch of green trees in the distance and said, "Yonder, the hacienda of my good friend, Mr. Wynne." The former Miss Smith was frightened at first, thinking they'd come to arrest her. But once she read the affidavit clearing her of all charges, she talked eagerly about Dean Bridgman Connor's illness and death. And all at once, Anthony J. Philpott of the Boston Globe knew she was telling him the truth. The boy had died from typhoid, and all the stuff about kidnapping was pure imagination. "Why, there's no question about Mr. Connor," she said. "I was with him at the end, and I was a witness when the grave was opened. I do not understand why his folks in Vermont refused to believe it." She wrote out a full account, and when it had been signed in the presence of witnesses, A.J. Philpott started for Boston. Now, before he announced his decision in this controversial case, which had been running in the Globe for many weeks, Philpott went to Vermont to check up on the evidence, which had been said to be faked in Mexico City. To his surprise, he found the photographs were so underexposed and out of focus, they were absolutely worthless. The local dentist, when pinned right down to it, admitted that sometimes fever does affect the appearance of teeth and tissue, to say nothing of their being in the ground for several months. And the physician, who had tended Deed all his life, also admitted that possibly he shouldn't have been quite so positive in some of his statements. "Yes, yes," he says, "I have heard that human hair can and does change color." So all the evidence, which had seemed so conclusive at the time, didn't amount to Hannah Cook. But how could one explain the revelations of Mrs. Piper? How had she been able to pick out the nurse's name and the strange name of Zaragoza and even drawn a sketch of a bridge and a statue, which she had never seen? There was only one conclusion: mind reading. Philpott figured that Mrs. Piper had quite unconsciously got the impression of the bridge and the statue from Prentice Dodge, the man who'd been to Puebla before him. He never did figure out where she got the name of Dr. Zinch or the location of his sanitarium, where Dean Connor was not found in the room she described so vividly as number 4. Now, you can find the details of this curious case in Mr. Philpott's book, which is called The Quest for Dean Bridgman Connor, published in 1914. He told me with justifiable pride that that book is in the psychology department of every college in America, and most of them in Europe, dealing as it does with hunches and dreams and people who were firmly convinced that something had gone wrong in spite of evidence that everything was in order. Mrs. Piper didn't mind when the Boston Globe said it was mind-reading, but Dr. Hodgdon, head of the American Society for Psychic Research, was fighting mad. "If I had the money," he told an audience in New York, "I'd go to Mexico tomorrow and bring Dean Connor back alive." To which General Charles H. Taylor, publisher of the Globe, said, "Tell the good doctor to go to Mexico, and if he does bring young Connor back alive, the Globe will pay the expenses and give him a handsome bonus beside." For years, Dr. Hodgdon went around the country lecturing. And time and again, he said, "After I have passed on to the spirit world, I shall come back and prove that Dean Connor was never in that grave, that he was alive and being held hostage. But like Houdini and many others, he hasn't been heard from." I don't know whether your library will have this book by Mr. Philpott, but the name again, in case you want the details, is The Quest for Dean Bridgman Connor. I've tried to find a copy for my own library, but I guess it's rather scarce. Anyway, this was one of the strangest assignments ever handed to a New England newspaper man.